This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good morning. I'd like to welcome you to Scripps. My name is Donna Blackman. I'm a professor in the chemistry department here at Scripps Research Institute. And I want to extend my welcome to all of you. It's a great crowd we have here. We're really excited to have you here. And we want to thank you for participating in what I think is going to be a really great Science Saturday events throughout the year. We want to thank Shirley King and Art Olson and Rich Wargo from UCSD, actually, for helping to make all this possible. And we have a very, very generous anonymous donor who really is the person that helped to make all this possible. So thank you very much. I want to let you know that you're in for, I think, a very exciting experience this year is in store for you. You're going to get a chance to find out about science and scientific careers from scientists themselves and from scientists in training themselves. And so that, I think that's really the best way to find out about something is by doing it or, you know, being with the people who do it. Scientists, you know, we have some of the best, and in fact, who you're going to hear mostly from are our younger scientists, and that includes the scientists in training. And I think that's really the most important thing for you to hear at this stage is how people got started and what made them go into these areas and what they do with their time all day if they're working all day in a lab. And we have scientists that come from all over the world to work, to train here, to become scientists at Scripps, and also to work here at Scripps, have their careers here at Scripps. And we think this is because Scripps provides an amazing research environment for scientists to work in. One of the sort of key words is interdisciplinary. We're interdisciplinary. We're scientists from all different areas of science that collaborate across all kinds of boundaries. And I think this is really important. This is something important for you to consider if you think about a career in science. Because if you think about the kinds of problems that we're facing, challenging scientific problems of today and tomorrow, they can't be pigeonholed into one area of science. And they can't really be solved by one scientist by themselves. We have to work in teams and we have to work across various boundaries to tackle big issues. So for the kinds of things we work on here, we need biologists, we need chemists, we need neuroscientists, we actually need engineers, we need informatics people, we need computational scientists. So whatever area of science you think you might want to work in, that may you may change your mind as you go along a journey, and that's actually part of science as well. But anything that you decide to start out studying will help you in a career, develop a career in science, regardless of you know, a nonlinear path that it may take you in. So you can actually start out in one field in science and end up in another. I'll tell you a little bit about our speaker today, and you can see that her pathway was not a straight line to get to where she is. And I'm another case in point. I studied engineering. My father was an engineer, and he said, you should all be engineers. And my sister wanted to be a lawyer, and he said, be an engineer first, then be a lawyer. So he had this idea that engineering was the only thing. So by the time it got to me, fourth in the family, I saw all these other fights. I said, okay, I'll just be an engineer. And so I studied engineering. And but now I work on helping to make drug molecules, pharmaceuticals, more efficiently, finding routes, organic chemistry to help make drugs more efficiently. And so my engineering background helped a lot, and it's a nonlinear path, but I ended up somewhere that I'm really passionate about what I do. And so making that first choice about what to study is not the most important one. It'll take you to other choices as you go along. So the sort of theme here is to just go with whatever you're curious about now, dive in, and see where it takes you. And don't ever sell yourself short. If you think science is hard, I can't do this, people tell me science is hard. Lots of things are hard. You know, if you play sports, sports can be hard. But if you're passionate about it, you work really hard at something you're passionate about. The other thing that people think is they get intimidated by science because there's a lot of terminology. Like, I don't know if I understand that. You could say the same thing in the sports analogy. I mean, if you're not, if you didn't know anything about football and somebody said, yeah, it's third down and three on the 20-yard line, I mean, those are words that you know individually. But if you don't know the rules of football, they don't mean anything to you. I worked in England. I worked in London at Imperial College as a professor for 11 years. And when I moved there, they had this game called cricket. Does anybody know cricket? Though, I mean, think about weird terminology. Like, they have silly mid-ons and they have, like, you know, sticky wickets and you have to do the follow-on. And I mean, it just makes no sense. But if it's a sports, you don't say, oh, I must not be smart enough to understand that. You say, oh, I haven't been told those definitions. So think about that in science. Don't sell yourself short. You know, when you get into a field, the deeper you get into it, the more you'll get into the jargon. But it's, you know, don't let that stop you from getting interested in science. Because at the heart, science is about problem solving. And we're all problem solvers. You do it every day in your life. You solve problems. You think, you see, you make an observation. You see something happening on the street. You say, why is that? What happened? You know, you see after an event and you try to reconstruct in your mind, what happened? And this is the kind of questions we ask all the time in science labs. We ask, you know, why did that happen? How did it happen? How can I make it happen differently? If we're studying disease, we think, how can I make that not happen so that, you know, this disease won't happen? And so you spend, you know, basically at heart, we're all scientists. It's just that when you have scientific training, it teaches you how to make observations and ask questions and answer questions that come from these observations. It teaches you how to look for the answers. And if you think about some of the really big problems, if you're trying to cure diseases like cancer or you're trying to solve problems like the Ebola virus, one of our young professors, Eric Ullman-Sapphire, has been in the news lately in conjunction with trying to help solve, come up with vaccine for Ebola virus. These are all big questions, and you don't solve it all in one go. You basically put pieces together of a puzzle. I like to tell the students working with me that it's like putting together a big jigsaw puzzle. You know, you make an observation, and this gives you one piece of information, and it's here, and there's another piece over here, and you have to work to figure out how they fit together. And when you make a piece click into place, that's a really good feeling. And it doesn't happen. That's another reason why interdisciplinary is important and teamwork is important, because you need lots of people in a team to help put these puzzles together. So you know, working a lot with other people, some people have an image of scientists sitting alone in an ivory tower. That's not true. Science is a very social medium. You have to work a lot with a lot of people and with different talents and different backgrounds, and you learn to work together. So if you listen to the news these days, there's a lot to get depressed about, right? You hear about climate change. You hear about diseases like the Ebola virus. You hear about gas prices going up and energy alerts that we've had with this terrible hot weather we've been having. You know, basically, your generation is going to face some of the biggest and most challenging problems mankind has ever faced. But I have to tell you that I'm actually jealous of you starting out now, because your generation also has the best chance and the best opportunities to solve these problems. Because of the science that's gone before and the tools that are being developed, you are going to be poised to solve a lot of these big problems. And so just think about how wonderful that will be for you, if you're a scientist, being able to be part of solving some of these really seemingly intractable puzzles, you know, problems which I call puzzles that we're faced. So you guys are really the problem solvers of tomorrow. And that's if you have a career in science, that's what you can think of yourself as. So now I want to introduce our speaker today, who is one of our problem solvers at Scripps and in the world. She's tackling some very big problems and solving them. And this is Sandra Encalada. Her title is Professor Encalada, who is the Arlene and Arnold Goldstein Assistant Professor in the Department of what's called Experimental and Molecular Medicine. Okay. And I'm not going to tell you much about her talk or what she's her area of research, because she's going to walk you through that, literally, actually. But I'll tell you about her background. She was born in Quito, Ecuador, okay? And she came to the U.S. She spent time as a kid in the U.S. in Northern California. I think her father was on sabbatical at Stanford or was a student at Stanford. And she also spent time in New Mexico getting ready to go to college in the U.S. She was in Northern California, New Mexico. Then she moved to Indiana to do a degree, and she did a degree in physics. Okay, and as part of that degree, she had a project in ecology that took her to Puerto Rico, and there she got really interested in biology, biological systems. So, of course, the next logical step is to go to Florida and study sea turtles, right? You know, that's what you do. And so she did that for a while. Then she went back across the country to Oregon, where she did a PhD in molecular genetics. Okay, and then that led her down to San Diego, first at UCSD and now at Scripps, working essentially working for cell biologists. I'll let her tell you about the kind of diseases she's tackling with the tools that she's learned. But you can see this idea I said about, you know, nonlinear path or studying one thing and ending up somewhere else. you know, both nonlinear geographically and in terms of the types of science. And I'll bet she would tell you that all those experiences come together and help her in the work that she does now, even though they seem very far apart from each other. And that's, you know, that's essentially what I think the message is about, is that, you know, science is very broad. You can start out studying one thing and end up in another, and all these experiences help you to become a better scientist, a better problem solver. That's really what it's all about. She's going to help show you how she's finding out how you can bring all these different interactions or different talents that you have together to help solve big scientific problems. So with that, I will turn it over to Sandra to tell you about her research.
Very good. Yeah, good morning. So thank you, Donna. And I want to thank also Shirley and her team and everybody at UCSD-TV for helping this happen, as well as our very generous sponsor, and Rachel Meisner, who has been wonderfully helping with the handouts that you have today, as well as the mentors that are here spread out throughout you who are helping us today. And so, yeah, so I want to tell you today a little story. And as Donna mentioned, I came about and I'm sort of trying to merge a couple things together as I started my lab a few years ago here at Scripps to talk about a very important biological question that can help us, I think, eventually lead to some therapies that could cure some diseases that are very prevalent today among us. Okay? So the title of my talk is Transport and Traffic Jams, and I will let you know what I mean by that in a minute. In how molecular nanomachines mobilize inside neurons, okay? And hopefully this will become apparent in a minute. So I want to tell you first that my lab is really interested in studying how the brain works, and we use a couple little helps for this, right? So we're going to talk today a little bit about the human brain and how we have used in our lab, and many other labs are using this as well, a couple helps, the mouse and this tiny little worm that is about a millimeter in length, in order to help ask and answer some of these questions about the human brain, which is very complex, because these organisms are much simpler to study things on, and we can do this because, amazingly enough, the mouse and the worm share many, many things with humans, proteins and genes inside of us, and so we can learn a lot from studying these very simpler, more simpler organisms, and then the hopes is that what we learn from them can apply back to our understanding of the human brain and hopefully, like I said, apply some therapies and come up with some medicines to cure some diseases of the human brain. Okay? So let's start by introducing a little bit the brain, right? So everybody has a brain, and it's awake right now, hopefully. And so the brain is our control center, right? Just about everything we do is controlled by the brain, right? And this is a very complex system and is done partly through connections from the brain to all the parts of our body via this nervous system that we call, right? So these are nervous fibers that are connected through the spinal cord, and one of the ones that I'll highlight, because it'll come up in a few other slides, is called this one right here, is the sciatic nerve, which is a very long nerve, okay? And so the brain, right here again, it basically controls many, many of our functions, just about everything we do. For example, it controls how we move, how we learn, how we think, how we remember, how we create memories, right? And even how we feel, right? So all of these things are very tightly controlled by this brain of ours. But what happens when we age? Sometimes when we age, the brain stops working as well as when we're younger, right? And so I want to show you a picture of a healthy brain first. And this is a cut through a brain, a healthy human brain, right? So you can see that here. But when we age, actually, sometimes the brain doesn't look very well. This is a picture of an ailing brain. And so what's the difference here between those two brains, right? So what's the difference here? The very obvious difference is the size, right? The size of the brain. This ailing brain is a lot smaller. And why do you think this brain is a lot smaller? Why is it something has happened to it, right? So what has happened is some cells have died, okay? And what happens with things that die in the brain when we're older? They're diseases, right? And who is familiar with some of these diseases of older brains, when we get older? Who knows? Yes?
Alzheimer's.
Very good. Alzheimer's disease is one of them. Exactly. Can you think of another in addition to Alzheimer's disease? Yes, over here. So we have Alzheimer's disease. Maybe a lot of people might know someone who has Alzheimer's disease,
dementia.
Right? Dementia, which is Alzheimer's, is partly also a type of dementia. That's right. Dementia is part Alzheimer's.
Somebody Parkinson's.
Says, Parkinson's disease. That's correct. Oh, well, there you go. Right. That's a good answer. So Alzheimer's disease, right? Our former President Reagan had Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, right? Michael J. Fox. And Lou Gehrig's disease is another example, actually, of a disease that affects brain, eventually the brain, but also the nerves of our hands and legs. And Stephen Hawking has this disease, right? So this disease is actually a quite common nowadays in our society, and they could affect us directly or indirectly, almost all of us, right? And so that's what happens when a brain doesn't work very well. And so what is it about the brain that doesn't work when we get Alzheimer's disease, right? So I'm going to introduce you to the main players in the brain. And these are the cells that make up the brain. These are called neurons. Have you guys heard of neurons? Yeah, your neurons right now are firing. As you're listening to this talk, as you're thinking, as you're breathing, they're making connections, right? And so here's a picture of a neuron, right? So these neurons are actually, yeah, they're in your handout, exactly. These neurons are very, very special types of cells, right? They're a cell, but they are different than the cells that you have on your skin, for example, right? Because one of the things that makes them very different and special is that they have these very long projections, okay? And these projections are called axons, okay? And in addition to that, they have this main control center for the neuron, which is called the cell body, right? And so these projections that come out of the cell body are very important because they use these to communicate with the neuron nearby, right? And they make these connections here in this little place called the synapse. And so they fire all kinds of information there that has to jump from one neuron to the other in order for connections to be made. For example, an example of one of these connections is memory formation, okay? And so these neurons exist in the brain, but they also exist throughout our body, right? So for example, here in the sciatic nerve, you have other neurons as well, but they're not brain neurons, obviously. They're from our legs, okay? And so the amazing thing about our brain is that we have so many neurons, right? 100 billion neurons in our brain. So that's a really large number. How many zeros make 100 billion neurons? Can somebody take a guess or can remember? Shout out one. Nine? Okay, let's count them, right? 100 billion neurons make for 11 zeros, right? That's a whole lot of zeros, a whole lot of neurons, right? Yep. And they're all firing right now, okay? And so what happens is these neurons make connections in the brain, right? And they are so many of them, they have to know exactly who they're talking to and connecting, and they form these networks in order to do this, right? So this is just an example of one of these networks of neurons that I've depicted here a whole lot simpler than it actually is, of course, in our brains. And so in these networks, what we see is that there's a lot of communication between these neurons, right? So the brain is firing activity. Like I said, as we're sitting, as we're breathing, when we're sleeping, at any moment, there's a lot of electrical activity. And this is one of the ways that neurons use to communicate with one another, okay? Another way that neurons communicate with one another is by transporting things from here, because this is where everything is made in the neuron. But you need to take all these different things that are needed in the neuron all the way along this long axon in order for things to also jump. Now, these are not electrical activities like I showed you in the previous slide. These are actually things like proteins and components that get just made here, but the neuron needs it in order for it to survive, Okay? And this process here of moving things to the synapse is called anterograde transport. Okay? This is a transport system that the neuron has. And this is what my lab studies, and I will tell you about this for the rest of the presentation, right? But likewise, there are other components that need to be taken also back from the very tips, the synapse, back to the cell body. And these are because these neurons next to them also are signaling back toward this neuron. So there's all this communication going back and forth that is very important. Now, what kinds of things are, why is transport important? Why do you think? I mean, I already told you that the neuron needs to because it has this very, you know, this important system. But why is it really important, right? We have to have a very good sense of why transport is such an important process. And one of the reasons is because neurons are very, very big. They're very large, right? So this is a beautiful picture that was taken a very long time ago by a scientist that won the Nobel Prize for describing a lot of the neurons in our body and studying them. And here it is, this very large neuron, where the cell body that I showed you earlier is right up here, and you can see all these connections that these branches that it makes, in this very, very long axon before it reaches potentially another neuron, right? In the human body, we also have very, very long neurons. Some of them are in the brain, but the longest ones are actually in our body. So I showed you already one. Can you remember which one, or do you know which one is one of the longest ones that we have in our body? The sciatic nerve, yes. And so, for example, in this human, this ballerina, the sciatic nerve, the cell body starts all the way here in the back of our spines, right? And that single neuron runs all the way along our leg to the tip of our toes. And this is how, when she steps on her toes or wiggle them, the body can sense that because this very long axon transmits information back to here and from here to the brain, and the brain then registers that you're wiggling your toes. Okay? So this one long axon needs to manage to transfer information all the way down and all the way back. Now that's a big challenge because these axons are not only long, but they're very thin. They're like a very tiny little thread. And there's many, many things that need to be connected back and forth from here to here. So these highways of things moving back and forth are very, very crowded. So you need to be able to take them and know exactly how to go so that there are no traffic jams, right? And so here's the sciatic nerve that I showed you earlier. That's depicted here, okay? So what things move inside neurons? What are the things that you think can be transported? Yes, a question.
For the sciatic nerve that goes down to your leg, why is it so long? Why aren't there just multiple small ones?
Very, very good question, right? The question is, why is the sciatic nerve just one neuron, long neuron, as opposed to many small ones, right? We actually don't know why, right? We just know that there are. However, I must tell you that there are many other neurons that are smaller, that go to different parts of the leg that also help in the sensing, right? In both temperature sensitivity as well as motion that allow for this to do that. And also the sciatic nerve itself is not just one long axon with it branches out, okay? So that might actually take into account a little bit to try to break down the job that this very long axon has to break it down into smaller pieces. You see how this branches out from here? So it helps a little bit with the distance perhaps, right? But it is a very good question because how is it that humans have, you know, obtained this as opposed to very, very small ones? I think probably one of the reasons is because we need a direct communication from the very, very farther, the things that are farthest from the brain, right? We need one direct communication that needs to be very faithfully communicated back to the brain, and perhaps the easiest route and the fastest route is one, right? So this is perhaps one of the reasons. Yeah, that's a very good question. Okay, So what things move inside neurons, right? What gets made inside a neuron? So in order to know what goes in, let's open up a neuron and let's see what's in there, okay? So here's the neuron that I showed you earlier, and we're going to enlarge this part right here, right? So this is the edges of the neuron. And when we do this, what we see is the neuron is lined up, this very long axon, remember it's a very thin tube, is lined up with this little tubules. They're called microtubules, and they're lined up all along this long axon. And they look and serve as railroad tracks, as I'll show you in a minute, for what needs to be moved up and down this long axon, okay? So we have the railroad tracks, and you can see them in a neuron here. So this is an actual picture of a neuron that is depicted here. Somebody looked at it under the microscope. And these green parts here are these little railroad tracks. You can't see them because we haven't zoomed in too far right now to see them, okay? But they're lined up all along these axons. So what else do we have in there? We have in there the actual cargo that needs to get moved up and down the axon, right? And one of these cargos, there are many, many, many of them, right? But one of them is mitochondria, okay? So now, who knows who has heard of mitochondria before? Lots of people. Yeah, so who can tell me what mitochondria is good for? What are mitochondria good for? Sorry, there.
It produces energy.
Very good. Yes, yeah, so mitochondria produce energy, ATP, right? So the cell, the neuron, needs energy in order to do whatever it needs to do, right? Just like you need energy. Where do we get our energy? You just got your energy a little bit earlier from your breakfast, right? So we need energy. The neuron needs energy from mitochondria, okay? So what happens is the neuron makes mitochondria right here, but it needs to take it all the way along this axon in order for the axon to also have energy, okay? And how does it do this, right? Remember that this is a very thin tube. You can't really just squeeze it in, right? You have to actually grab it and take it. So the mitochondria gets taken in by being grabbed, held by these two little motors. They're little nanomachines that are called motors, in this case motor 1 and motor 2, that grab mitochondria and bind, attached to this little microtubules like railroad tracks, and they literally walk them along the axons, okay? And to give you an analogy, right, so here's a little bit how they walk them, all right? And I'm going to show you some real pictures of how this happens. But an analogy is a train, right? So the train has an engine. The engine is the analogous to these motors, right? This is the actual machine that moves things. And the cargo is here, the mitochondria is analogous to the cargo that a train would take, okay? And so the train goes on the railroad tracks, okay? This is very similar to what happens. So we have that system. So now what does the mitochondria transporting inside a neuron look like, right? So we're actually going to look at this. And in order to do this, what we do in our lab and a few other labs is they use the help of a little mouse, okay? And why is because with mice, we can study their neurons in the lab, okay? So we grow their neurons in petri dishes, in little dishes, and we can study transport inside of them, okay? So this is an axon. I'm going to show you a movie of one of the axons that we grow from the mice in our lab. And what we have here is we've lit up the mitochondria. And we can do this because we put these little proteins here in mitochondria inside these axons that turn on when you shine light on them. Okay, they're fluorescent proteins, so they fluoresce. And so you can very easily see this mitochondria. Okay, and so what happens is when you take a look at these inside axons, you can see them moving all the way. So is this the axon? You can barely see the axon, right? But it sort of follows this trajectory here. But when you make a movie under the microscope at very high resolution, not as high as certain microscopes, and one of our speakers in February will tell you about these motors in very, very high resolution. His name is Gabe Lander. But at this resolution, you can see the movement of these mitochondria in axons, okay? And so this is the way that these little motors bind to that mitochondria and take it all the way along the axon, right? Now, to show you a little bit better how this might work, this is an animation that some people have put together at Harvard based on the actual structures of these little motors. And perhaps you're familiar with this movie, but what it is, what we'll have here is here are the railroad tracks, the microtubules. Here's our little motor, okay? And here is the cargo, which could be a mitochondria, okay? So what we're going to see here is how this motor, we think, and scientists think that these motors are actually moving. And here it is. Here's our little bipedal friend. It has two little legs and two little hands. And with the hands, it grabs onto the motor. And with the little legs, it walks it along. And this, of course, is an animation, as you can appreciate, right? However, this is very faithfully based on the studies of scientists, including some scientists here at Scripps, Ron Milligan, and also Gabe Lander, who will tell you about his beautiful studies of the structures of these in February. We really think that based on that, those studies, we think that this is actually how these motors walk along the axons, all the way down, okay? And it's a little bipedal motor. Okay, so what happens? What do you think happens when suddenly transport fails? Well, if you put a blockage there and the motors can walk, what happens? What happens if you block this transport in this very thin axon? Yes?
A traffic jam.
So what happens when transport fails? Traffic jams could happen, right? So I wanted to give you an analogy, a little bit of how in a very crowded axon, how things could work or how things couldn't work, right? And I wanted to give you an analogy by showing you a very, very busy highway in Thailand, okay? Here's a little movie of things when things are working well, when traffic or transport is working well. There you go. Look at that. It's very, very crowded and busy, and yet when things work, amazingly enough, they work really, really well, right? That's pretty crazy, right? No traffic jams there, right? So this is similar to what this is similar what you would see in an axon with normal transport. You don't see any traffic jams, right? However, when you get a traffic jam, like in this image, and I believe this might be in Moscow. I'm actually playing the movie right now. I'm actually playing it, but there's not much happening, right? I mean, a few lucky guys I got over here, but very unhappy cars over here, right? When you get traffic jams, you get pileups, right? And that's, yep, they're not getting out there very soon, right? And so this will be similar to, in an axon, what we would find here. Okay, so when you get traffic jams, basically, it's like you block things, right? It's like you have a hose of water, running water, but you block it. What happens then when you have water running through a hose and you put your hand and you hold it really tight, right? Water balloons. And this is an example of an axon, a real axon, that has this traffic jam, right? It's ballooned and it has these swellings because things can get through, right? And so why is this important, right? So if we go back to our ailing brain here, remember? It turns out that ailing brains in Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, Huntington's disease, Lou Gehrig's disease, almost every neurodegenerative disease that we know of have these traffic jams, okay? And so what we think in our lab and other labs think is that defects in this transport might be what leads to some of these neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's, okay? And so my lab is interested in testing this hypothesis that these traffic jams are what leads to disease, okay? And so one of the things, as Donna mentioned earlier, that labs do and scientists do, and you have done in your science classes perhaps, is we test hypotheses in order to investigate how the world works around us, right? And so one of the questions that we are interested in my lab is in deciphering whether motors are necessary for transport, right? Because I told you now that these mitochondria use these little motors to do that. But why don't we test that? How did we find this out? How did this come about that we knew that this motor, for example, motor 1, is involved in the movement of this mitochondria, right? So what I'm going to do right now is take you through a little example of how scientists, and you probably do it in science and in everyday lives, you test this hypothesis, right, this question. And so to do that, we're going to apply the scientific method to study this. Are motors carrying mitochondria inside these neurons? Okay? And so you have all heard of the scientific method. Is that right? Yep. And you apply it probably in science class, right? And you might think that it's a little bit, you know, tedious to do this. But in fact, this is exactly what we do every day in our lab. Okay? And so I'm going to take you through a little example of how we apply the scientific method. Scientific method is a series of steps that tell us about the world, right? That we follow in order to answer questions about the world around us. And so the scientific method has different steps. But depending on the science that you're doing and the question that you're asking, the steps can vary a little bit in terms of the order of them, okay? This is just an example of one of those steps. So we can start with a question, right? So in our example, our question could be, are motors involved in the transport of mitochondria, right? That's our question. Then if we formulate our question precisely, then we can formulate what's called a hypothesis. Who has heard of this word, hypothesis? Right, so hypotheses are very important because hypotheses tell us about how we can formulate the question, right? And so in our particular example, our question could be that we will test whether motor 1 moves mitochondria inside neurons. That's our hypothesis. We're going to test this, right? And hypotheses sometimes are phrased in terms of predictions. And so motor 1, you can phrase it as well, will be moving mitochondria, okay? Then our next thing, once we have the questions and hypothesis set up, is we want to test them, right? So we design an experiment to test this. Now, what would be a good design of an experiment to test whether motor 1 moves mitochondria? Can somebody tell me? What would be an example of how we can test this hypothesis? If motor 1 is, if we want to test if that's, motor 1 is working. Yes. With the mouse, okay, yep. And what would we do? What is our experimental design? What would we do?
You would have the control where motor 1 was there, and then you would take it away in another.
Very good. Yes. So here we have a proposal that we are going to design this. If we want to find out whether motor 1 is involved, then we want to remove it and see what happens to the movement of mitochondria. And that is exactly one of the ways that we can test this. We remove motor 1 and we look at mitochondrial transport. Yeah, very good. Then what do we do after that? We do our experiment and then now we observe what happens, right? We gather data. We go under the microscope and look. Right? And our observation, if this would be the case, is what happens in the absence when we remove motor 1, right? Do mitochondria move or not? That's what we're going to observe. And then after our observation, we can make our conclusion. If there's no movement, then motor 1 would be in charge of moving mitochondria, right? Okay, so let's walk through this, right? We have our questions, we have the hypothesis, and now we have also an initial observation. This is exactly the same movie that I showed you earlier, right? So mitochondria here. Mitochondria, when we don't do anything to a normal axon, is moving, just like before, right? So our experimental design was that we're going to remove motor 1 and then image the transport. So we do this in the lab with a little trick, and we can do this by applying certain things inside that neuron that removes this motor, okay? This is a little bit more complicated, so I'm not going to go into the details, but we have been able to do that. And here is a movie now of one of those axons without that motor 1. So what do you expect, if our hypothesis is correct again, what do you expect that we will see? Slower, either slower transport of mitochondria or no movement. Okay, so let's see what happens, right? We remove our motor. So the movie's playing right now. Okay, this movie's playing. You can see a little jiggling to see that the movie's actually playing. But what do we see? No movement. That's right. So when we remove the motor, mitochondria do not move. Okay? And so now, then, we can conclude that motor one moves mitochondria inside neurons. Okay? And so this is just an example of the scientific method as we apply it every day in the lab. So when you're doing this, perhaps in your own classrooms, remember this, that at every level, this is very, very, a very important process, in that everybody does this in science, and it's a very critical process in order to learn about the world, right? So then a next step, for example, would be to ask the question, well, now we can test whether removing that little motor can lead to neurodegeneration, right? So we can test now whether that motor removal would lead to this traffic jams, right? So we're not going to go through that today because that's a longer example. And now what I want to do is I want to tell you about another story about how we use another help, our other help that I introduced you to earlier, also to study transport. And that is using what we call the worm, right? So the worm is a very, very tiny organism. The scientific name of the worm is Caenorhabditis elegans. Does anybody know what that means? It's Latin. It's the scientific name of the worm. Maybe this rings a little bit of a bell, elegans, right? That sounds a little bit like elegant, right? And in fact, it is. The name means elegant little stick, okay? Somebody named it like that. So it's a very tiny worm, and I will show you why it is very elegant, okay? There it is. There's a movie of C. elegans. We call it C. elegans for short, or the worm. And you can see it moving. And this is a very high magnified image, of course, because the worm is a millimeter in length. Okay, very, very small. So we can only look at it through a microscope. All right? And so that's, and it looks a little flattened here in this movie, but in fact, it's a round worm. And you can look at it here better in this electron micrograph, which is a much better microscope to depict it. And here it is. So what does the worm, why do we use the worm, and where does it live? Like, how can we study it? So basically, the worm lives usually in soil. Okay, so if you go dig out a piece of soil and you grab it and you put it under your microscope, you'll see C. elegans coming crawling out. Okay, there's tons of them there. But we're able to put them inside little petri dishes like these and grow them in the lab very successfully. They're very happy as long as we give them their food. And we can look at them under a scope, and that's how we make the images that I showed you earlier. Okay? And so here's another image of a number of them under a microscope. Okay? And this is a sped up image, right? So you can see them, but you can see them moving quite fast. And they're smaller ones and they're bigger ones because they grow just like us, right? So they grow, and these are the little eggs, and they grow from there, they hatch, and then they grow. Okay, but these are the worms, so they grow very happily in these dishes, right? And we have used the worm because it has many, many, very good features. It grows very fast, and we can actually study many processes that also humans undergo because we share, it turns out, many, many things in common with worms, including this process of transport, okay? And one of the features that the worm is very great at for us is that it is transparent. Right, so you can see it in the first movie, but you can see it also here. You can almost see right through the worm. And I've put an image here, a diagram of the parts of the worm inside, so you can see it. It has an intestine. They're very simple organisms, right? But it has an intestine, and it has a mouth, and it has this organ that uses to eat. It's called a pharynx, which is coated here in green. And it has, and it reproduces, so it has the rest of what it needs to reproduce, right? And it has an intestine. So it is a very simple organism, but it's transparent. So we can actually study transport inside the worm without having to do anything to it, right? And so what we do is we light up the neurons, like the ones that I showed you earlier in mice, but now we light them in the worm. And here is a picture of one of those. Here's the worm, right? And we've lit up six neurons here. And these are the neurons of the worm. This is the cell body, remember, that I showed you earlier. And this is the axon. And this is another one. This is another one. And this is another one. Okay? You can see four here in this focal plane. All right? And we can look right through the worm when we put them in a microscope and we shine light on them. Okay? And I want to give you another example of another neuron, which is actually one of our favorites, and we study in the lab. And this one here has a lot of branches. These are axons that are very simple. They're single axons, but look at this one. It has tons of branches, okay? And those branches the worm uses in order to sense temperature, okay? Without it, it can't sense temperature. So the worm is transparent, right? So we can light up neurons, and also we can light up the little cargo, like the mitochondria you saw earlier, okay? And we can watch them inside, and we can watch them move. So I want to show you the next picture of one of these neurons now in the worm, not in the mouse, with a different type of cargo, one that I haven't shown you earlier, not mitochondria, but another one that also moves inside the worm. Okay, so this is our neuron, and this is the axon that comes from this part of this particular neuron, right? And so we've lit up the cargo, just like before the mitochondria, it's just a little different cargo, right? And you're going to see these cargo are a lot smaller than mitochondria. They're tiny, tiny little, they look like this little puncta, right? And you can see them move, and they move in two directions, right? They're actually, some of them are pretty small, so they're a little bit harder for, perhaps for you to see. But you can see, as this movie repeats, that some of them move right through. And they go right through the others, right? They're like, excuse, excuse, and they go, right? And they go there, and then they come back as well, okay? And so that's one of the things that our lab uses also in order to study this process of transport in the worm, okay? The other way that we use worms is to also study neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease, okay? And the way we do that is we make transgenic animals, and we eject in genes that we know are involved in Alzheimer's in humans. We put them inside the worm, and we can actually see that these worms resemble some of these defects that happen in Alzheimer's disease in humans. Okay? And so I want to give you an example of that. Okay, so we're gonna inject worms with some genes that are involved in Alzheimer's or Huntington's disease in this case. And this is very, very helpful for us because this is a system that is very easy to study and manipulate, and we can really, really work with this system and learn a lot, right? So what we've done here is we have normal worms that do not have any disease, but we've lit up the worm, the muscle of the worm, so you can see the muscle in the worm, okay? And that's green. So I'm going to show you a movie of how well they move when they're normal. So you can see the worms here move really, really well when they're normal, and we've lit up the muscle so you can see them, right? But when we express, when we put things in the muscles of these worms that are otherwise normal, genes that are involved in a neurodegenerative disease, this is what we see instead. These things start making aggregates, okay? And you can see the aggregates of these worms, and the worms, even though they're the same age, they should be moving well. Now, because they have this gene that in this case models Huntington's disease, which is another disease of neurodegeneration, now the worms start looking sick, and they can move well, and a lot of these aggregates form. And this is similar. This gets worse, actually, when the worms get older. So getting to your question as to why aggregates get older, in older worms they get worse, is we think that over time, any tiny little traffic jam that starts can get worse if another thing gets piled up there, and another thing piles up there, and another one piles up there. And over time, as the worm gets older, or as the human gets older, they get worse and worse. That's how we think that these traffic jams get worse with age. Okay, but we're trying to figure out ways by understanding how the traffic jams occur in the first place, come up with therapies and ways to make them better and to make them disappear. So I'm almost toward the end of my presentation, so I just want to give you a little summary to summarize what I've told you today, right? So in summary, what I've mentioned to you today is that this process that we call transport inside neurons is very, very critical and important for the health of neurons and thus for a healthy human brain, okay? And we can use model organisms like the little mouse and the worm in order to study how this process of transport works in healthy neurons as well as when it doesn't work where we think neurodegeneration happens, right? And we use the scientific method in order to study these processes, right? And then what we hope then is that we will be able to apply the knowledge that we've learned from these model systems about this transport and how neurodegeneration can occur in order to start creating and designing and working with other scientists like chemists come up with medicines and therapies in order to treat human diseases like neurodegenerative diseases. Okay? And so I'd like to acknowledge a few people here that have made this possible because, you know, even though I'm here presenting this to you, there's a number of people behind this work that I want to acknowledge who are the actual worker bees behind all of this, right? And so, first of all, I want to acknowledge and thank the generous support of our sponsor for this Science Saturday series, and who has made this possible today for you, and also thank Shirley King and Rachel Meisner. They have been organizing this together and have done a marvelous job at together with their teams at UCSD TV in the Kellogg Graduate School of Science and Technology at Scripps Research Institute. Don, Ryan, and Laura have been very instrumental to making Science Saturdays happen. And I want to especially thank my group at TSRI. This group of incredibly talented students and postdoctoral fellows are the people that make this happen. All of the data that you saw is gathered by them. And in fact, one of them, I think, is sitting somewhere here, Danielle, right there. She is in my lab, and she is part of one of your mentors today, which I also want to thank. Thank you to the mentors. In fact, let's give them a round of applause to all of these people.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.